be everything. Scullery maid, housekeeper, and nurse. Satisfied with her preparations, Mary lit a kerosene lantern and hung it on its hook outside. Alerted by this signal, it did not take more than 15 minutes for women to straggle in by ones and twos, clutching woolen shawls over their exposed shoulders. Within a half an hour of opening, 12 women had gathered, and once inside they slouched against the walls, their eyes following Mary about the room. Unadorned by face paint and the cheap satin of their working attire, the women nonetheless wore their hard lives in their sallow skin and rheumy eyes. Their sickly appearance always shocked Mary. 3 years ago, when she had first begun, it had upset her to learn that a prostitute's average lifespan after beginning in the trade was just 4 years. They aged quickly, and died quickly too.
"Where have you been?"
This sullen question was uttered by a woman who called herself Darlene. Darling, a name chosen long ago after having discarded her real name to save herself from any memory of who she had once been. They all had names like that. Honey, Sweetie, Clementine. Names crafted of fantasy and sweetness when their lives were anything but. They all said their last names were Addison, a name they gave when they were arrested. So many women named Mrs. Addison had been arrested for prostitution in the past few years in Albany that the police had given up trying to extract the truth from them. Still, it was better than the name Mary Balls, the previous incarnation of a shared name, a sly joke that had infuriated the police when, after many times of carefully inscribing it in the police ledger, they finally caught on. A plump woman past 30, Darlene had pinned her hennaed hair carelessly this morning into a ragged snood.
"Where?" she said again.
"I apologize," Mary said. "It wasn't my intention to abandon you, but I had something important to attend to." As a rule, Mary told them as little as possible about herself. She was their caretaker, not they hers, and when they pried, she answered their questions as cordially and obscurely as possible. Even now, when she believed they would readily accept her more than acceptable excuse for desertion, she preferred to reveal nothing.
"Seems like you could have warned us," Darlene said, hugging her arms to her chest.
A feverish sheen glistened on her forehead.
"I traipsed down here 3 Thursdays in a row looking for you before I gave up."
"Didn't you see the notice I tacked up, to say it would be a while before I could return?"
"Well, if I could read, then I would have, wouldn't I?"
"I'm sorry," Mary said. She didn't begrudge Darlene her anger. Mary had been loath to keep the clinic closed, but she'd had only enough energy to keep the house clinic open. And for weeks after the blizzard, snow had made travel treacherous.
"Now, who can I help first?"
The door burst open, and a thin woman named Glynnis, Mary could never discern whether she was just thin or truly emaciated, hurried in, carrying her 5-year-old daughter Maud, whom she was raising in the whorehouse where they lived. That morning, Glynnis had discovered Maud lying on the attic floor, where they slept with the other inmates of the house, in cots lined up under the eaves. The listless child was drooling excessively and breathing loudly, as if through a narrow pipe. Within seconds, Mary performed an examination and diagnosed quinsy, a throat abscess that was causing Maud's tonsil to swell. Quickly, Mary set up for the minor surgery, arranging her instruments and washing the back of Maud's throat with borax. The child was so feverish that she did not protest. With ease, Mary was able to nick the abscess with a scalpel, irrigate the girl's mouth of the draining pus, and deliver her into her relieved mother's arms, the whole thing from exam to execution, taking perhaps 5 minutes. Only then did Mary notice that her audience was gaping at her. Perhaps, she thought, she ought to have pulled the burlap curtain. She washed her hands and asked who was next. Darlene lurched forward and held out her arms, revealing that the reason for her earlier disgruntlement was that she was in pain.
A drunken client had slashed the underbelly of her forearms with a razor. This time Mary did draw the curtain before washing the festering wounds with carbolic soap, noting as she did that Darlene's hair was riddled with lice.
"People count on you, you know," Darlene said as Mary scrubbed. "You disappear, and we all wonder whether you're ever going to come back. What would have happened to Glynis's girl if you hadn't been here?"
"I will always come back, Darlene. How long ago did this happen?"
"Saturday? Friday? I can't remember."
5 days, then, at least. If Mary had gotten to the cuts earlier, she could have stitched them. But now it was too late. "You must wash these every day. Do you have any carbolic soap?" Darlene shrugged. "I'll give you a bar. Boil your water, then let it cool before you begin. And I'll give you a bottle of lysbane, too. Wash your hair in it twice." Darlene nodded in a distracted way.
"What kind of problem takes more than an entire month to fix? Were you sick? You don't look sick."
"Something personal."
"As if my arms aren't personal, or my legs, or my hoochie, all of what you and every man in Albany has seen."
Mary patted Darlene's plump forearms with a clean towel, taking special care with the ridge of heat and redness surrounding the long, jagged cuts. "Soap, do you understand?" she said. "Soap. Wash these every day."
"It's been more than a month, hasn't it?"
Darlene said, studying her.
"Wasn't that when the blizzard hit?"
"Hold still," Mary said, winding bandages around the woman's forearms.
"You lost someone, didn't you?" Darlene persisted. "I can tell. Anyone who ignores questions has answers they don't want to let on."
Mary tied off the last bandage and washed her hands.
"If it's true, then that's nothing but a damn shame."
No one had said anything as blatant since the girls had gone. Mary shut off the faucet, dried her hands, and rooted out a roll of gauze and the bar of soap, and handed them to Darlene.
"Get someone to help you if you can."
"Who?" Mary shook her head, knowing that Darlene was not asking for suggestions about who should help her.
"Did they die?"
Mary looked up at the window, to the cool rays of the morning sun filtering through the glass. "You come back next week if those cuts get worse."
"Talking to you is like trying to rouse a man's reluctant Johnson to happiness."
"Just tell me, won't you?
Did they run away? Die? What?"
Mary turned. "My nieces. Or rather, children I consider to be my nieces. We don't know what happened. They left school on the day the storm ended and then vanished."
"Have you looked for them?"
"Everywhere. All the orphan asylums, the hospitals. We put notices in the paper."
"Is that all?" Darlene scoffed. "For someone as skilled as you, you're not too smart, are you? Did you look along the waterfront, down the alleyways, in any of the houses, in the Tenderloin, at the far end of Broadway where the lights burn red?"
"No," Mary said. She felt Darlene's incredulous stare and the damp chill of the room. They hadn't even thought to look in the whorehouses. She'd tended these women for several years now, and in the past 6 weeks, had never once made the connection.
"But who would take them? Anyone thinking they could make some money?"
Darlene looked at her sharply.
"You've lived too easy a life."
She hadn't, of course, but Mary said nothing.
"We'll all keep an eye," Darlene said, reading Mary's panic. "Won't we, girls?"
Wincing, Darlene drew aside the curtain. The thin fabric had not muffled their conversation. The dozen waiting women eyed Mary with pity, because they knew things that they never told her, no matter how frank they were with her about their lives.
"Have any of you seen them?"
Mary said, her voice trembling. "They are 7 and 10. Long red hair, big eyes. Blue? Their names were are Emma and Claire. No one had seen them, but they promised they would look. I hope you don't find them, Darlene said, her voice gone soft with sympathy. Miserably, Mary nodded. Us too. Already, Maud showed signs of improving health. Her breathing was regular and deep, her pulse steady and firm. It had taken only the release of the infection to reverse her fever. The girl was just stirring when the door shot open, and Captain Mantell and 5 uniformed police officers burst into the room. Chapter 8. Instinctively, Mary stepped between her patients and the policeman as Darlene slunk toward the far wall and the other women. Mantell tilted his head to one side, eyeing them all with suspicion. Light glinted off the brass buttons of his uniform as he took Mary's measure. She realized what she must look like to him now. Her clinic dress, though presentable, was made of gray worsted serge, the fabric of utility, and her hair was pinned up carelessly, without style, though she rarely paid much attention to it on any given day. On Thursdays, she dressed this way to avoid attention, easily passing on her way to the clinic as yet another shop girl, though as a rule she cared little for the gewgaws and fripperies of fashion, dispensing with a trip to the dressmaker's in as little time as possible, asking only to be outfitted in something acceptable, and taking what the dressmaker made without complaint or comment, though it was often still too decorative for her indifferent taste.
So, it is true, Mantell said.
I beg your pardon?
The rumors. Oh, I could hardly believe them at first. The lady doctor of Washington Park, treating prostitutes.
What concern is it of yours?
Helping these degenerates, not reforming them like the genial folks at the House of Shelter, is what we in the righteous business of law enforcement call abetting. I ought to throw you in jail.
He leaned to one side, surveying the women gathered behind her.
Or I could arrest them.
For what?
Standing?
Mary said.
You're the lady doctor that came into the precinct house, one of the policemen said.
Mary recognized Officer Farrell, the tall, sympathetic policeman who had been so kind the first time they'd gone to the precinct house.
We were on the lookout for those... your girls. Blizzard orphans, right? Drowned in the river, right?
He looked to Mantell for confirmation.
A shame, that. Shut up, Farrell!
Mary seized on the interruption. Officer Mantell, tell me, of all those places you told me you searched, did you ever go to the red light districts?
Now, Dr. Stipp, what a question.
He eyed the women massed behind her.
You're obviously still in a state. Though I understand, I do. After all, the whole of the Northeast is still suffering. It's been one long funeral for all of us. And we'd not got it so bad here in Albany. I got reports of infants froze to death in Boston. Stop!
He affected a pitying smile.
I apologize. Didn't mean to upset you. I forget, sometimes, that as a lady, you've not got the stronger constitution.
If you are going to patronize me, do it without that simpering smile. Mantell thrust his short legs wide.
Fine. Happy to. Let me tell you something. Now that you are consorting with the ladies of the night, it's probably best for you to understand what we men of the force have understood for a good long time. These women will lie, cheat, steal, and say anything in order to get what they want. You cannot trust a word that comes out of their mouths. I expect tomorrow or the next day you'll hear from someone here that she has found the girls. But she'll be needing some kind of payment for the information. And you'll give it to her, because you're desperate.
That's ridiculous, Darlene said, elbowing her way forward. Mantell ignored her.
You're thinking in wishes, Dr. Stipp. Hope has made you vulnerable to those who would do you harm or toy with your thinking. Like that one there, he said, jutting his chin at Darlene. But I was too hard on you last time. It's a sad thing what happened. You have my pity. You do. But you need to come to terms.
You didn't look there, did you? Mary said.
You're grasping, Dr. Stipp.
It would take nothing. Two thorough patrolmen, applying real method. The search could be accomplished by tonight.
You know as well as I do that as soon as a patrolman sets foot in one of those houses, a messenger will be out the back door, spreading the news that we're on the lookout for two girls. And those two girls would be well hidden by the time we get to where they are. Anyway, we're arguing about ghosts. Those girls are dead.
You're being obtuse, Mary said, or lazy.
Listen to me, Doctor. You've done more good work than most of us ever will in a lifetime.
Mantell's gaze swiveled around the clinic.
Except for this, of course. But we all know what you and your husband did in the war. A bit of an amazing thing, not what most women would do. And I honor that. I do. But I'll not go charging through the city's dens of iniquity because you've gotten an idea from loose women who want to please you or fleece you. Trust me on this. We are in and out of whorehouses all the time. If your girls were there, I'd have found them. Now go home. Get out of this place. Deliver a baby. Mend people's broken bodies. Go on doing the good deeds that people admire you for.
Though his tone was respectful, it was also patronizing, with an undercurrent of disdain. When people asked Mary about the war, they supposed that it had been a frustrating, awful experience. But in that lawless landscape, when she had wanted to accomplish something, all she'd had to do was to take steps to get it done. Climb onto trains going in the direction of battles. Talk her way through barriers, both prejudicial and material. In some cases, just show up until someone relented. That was how she'd met William. She'd arrived at the door of the Union Hotel Hospital, demanded he hire her, and wearied him into taking her on. Therein lay the advantage of wartime. Men were too busy killing one another to take heed of women's activities. But after the war, people's general opinion of her turned. She wasn't quite respectable. Her ambitions were unladylike. At best, she was a curiosity. She was aware that many society women who asked for her help eyed her with this same suspicion. And people like Mantell felt free to lecture her about what she could and could not do. And now, somehow, the police had discovered her clinic and were here, for a reason she couldn't discern. You need to leave, Captain Mantell.
How old did you say that oldest girl was?
10. He shrugged.
She was of age.
Mary stared at him, aghast. She is a child. Is. Was.
You know as well as I do that we can't interfere with a girl's rights to do whatever she wishes. If that's the life she's chosen, then
Emma and Claire didn't choose anything.
Madam, they are not alive. That's the end of it. And if I hear of you treating these women again, I will arrest you.
As he turned to leave, a man pushed through the crowd of officers at the door. At first he appeared only in silhouette, a top hat elongating his short stature, a velvet-lined cape flung across one shoulder, a confident cast to his bold stance. He removed his hat and offered a slight bow.
Dr. Stipp?
Mr. Vanderveer? Mary said. Garrett stepped inside and made a second bow to the captain. The two men resembled one another. Mantell had a broader, more barreled chest, but in the bald head, dark eyes, and even the way they held themselves, they could have been brothers. Only Mantell's thick accent distinguished him. Garrett's tone, while braying, was nuanced by the more aristocratic tones of Dutch Albany. Seen in shadow, though, it would be hard to tell them apart.
"I do hope nothing has happened. Is all well, Arthur?" "We were making rounds and heard a disturbance."
"There was no disturbance," Mary said.
"Surely you have no quarrel with this fine woman,"
Vanderveer said.
"This physician to whom we are all so much indebted."
The captain shot Mary a grim look that could be either apology or condemnation, which he nevertheless quickly wiped from his face. He turned to Farrell to commiserate over the things he had to put up with, pushed past Vanderveer, and trailed by his officers, sauntered down the alleyway. Garrett Vanderveer said,
"Are you all right, Dr. Stipp?"
"He is a loathsome man." Garrett glanced around the room, his assessing gaze missing nothing.
"I've come with an invitation, but I see that you are busy. May I return within the hour, or two? Name the time, it's important. Or at least I hope you will agree that it is, once we have spoken."
There were 11 more women to see, and the washing up to do afterward. 2 hours?
"I'll return then."
He tipped his hat and was gone. For the rest of the morning, Mary cared for the women's bruises, ailments, and diseases as they chattered at her, trying to console her. They heard things, they said. Men at their leisure liked to talk. They would listen, ask around. Mary forced herself to concentrate on her work, but was as rattled nearly as much as she had been at Antietam, when the men were bleeding to death in the barnyard, and she had only corn husks as dressings. "I'm not afraid," she had declared to William after their first night of surgery together. He had laughed at her then, incredulous that she would ever think he thought her afraid of anything. Now fury made her clumsy. Twice she tripped over her own feet, and once, when irrigating a sore, she knocked over the basin with her elbow, and it splashed onto the floor with a loud clatter. Could what Darlene said be true? By 12:30, when Garrett Vanderveer again knocked at the door, everyone had gone.
"Is this a bad time?" he said.
"Neither good nor bad. Tell me, how does everyone suddenly know about my clinic?"
"I can't speak for Captain Mantell, but I saw the lantern burning."
"And how do you know about the lantern?" He shrugged.
"Albany talks. I hear things."
"I offer these women medical care, Mr. Vanderveer. Care that no one else offers them."
"That's not completely true. There is the House of Shelter, for one, that offers help if they want to leave the profession, so to speak. But you mistake me. I did not come to pronounce censure, as it appeared Mantell did. Did he threaten you?"
"Yes." Mary untied her sodden apron and added it to the pile of laundry. "He insinuated that I've been performing abortions." Vanderveer was circling the room, taking in the uneven stone floor, bare walls, and sparse furnishings. He turned on his heel.
"Have you?"
"No."
"All right, then. I've come to make you an offer and an invitation. Actually, two invitations. I wish to fund this clinic, move you to a better space, pay the rent, give you money to obtain whatever medicines and instruments you require, get you out from underneath police harassment."
Vanderveer's smile widened into a deep grin. With his malleable face and short stature, he resembled an elf more than a lumber baron. "Why, when Mantell was auguring arrest?" Vanderveer shrugged.
"I hold a deep fondness for the downtrodden."
"If you knew me at all, then you would know that I don't accept glib answers."
"Very well," he said. "Two reasons. One, Albany is my city. I own it, at least as far as commerce goes, and I've little patience for corruption. At least 24 brothels operate on the waterfront. Elsewhere, they've sprung up like weeds. It's a scourge, and the injustice toward the women involved, which you have boldly confronted in this small establishment, makes me furious. And second, I'd like to help you.
By giving me money? He shrugged.
I have plenty.
You wish to be associated with prostitution? You, staunch Episcopalian, the richest man in the city with the highest social standing?
You honor me, but I don't think that the reigning families would agree with your assessment of my standing. I do not rank so highly on the social ladder. I do not live in their rarefied enclave on Elk Street, amidst their mansions and beloved cathedral. I live on the park, like you do. You are mistaking wealth with position. The two are not always congruent. But yes, I want to take a stand. Will you accept?
Your money would attract attention.
What if we tell no one that I am involved?
Mary gathered the towels and rags accumulated on the table and began stuffing them into a canvas bag. That's impossible. Albany lives for gossip. You said it yourself. I hear things.
I think you are being foolish. This is a good opportunity.
She cinched the laundry bag tight. Many men have thought me foolish, Mr. Vanderveer. That never has any bearing on what I do.
Viola says that I can be obtuse. If I have offended you, I apologize.
I am not easily offended. And now I need to get home, she said, pinning on her hat and herding him toward the door.
It could be an homage to the O'Donnells, Vanderveer said. We could name the clinic after them. The O'Donnell Clinic.
It's very kind, but I can't accept your money.
Very well. By the way, did I overhear you asking Mantell to search the brothels?
Yes.
Why?
Mary's gaze strayed to the open door, wishing to be gone. One of the women thought it possible that the girls might have ended up in one of them.
What did Mantell say to that?
That I am mistaken.
I'll say something to him.
It's not important.
There is that famous courage. Think about what I offered, won't you? I know how difficult things have been for you lately, and I admire all...
He opened his hands.
This. But you forget. I also came bearing an invitation.
They stepped into the alley, where runnels of sudsy water rippled among the cobbles from the washhouse up the hill. Dirty piles of snow still banked some of the buildings. Mary handed Garrett the laundry, enjoying the insolence of burdening one of the most noteworthy men in Albany with a sack of dirtied linens. But he waited good-naturedly enough while she wrapped herself in her cloak, snuffed the lantern, and placed it inside before locking the bolt and thrusting the key deep into her pocket. She directed him uphill toward the washhouse, where she dropped off the laundry, and then turned downhill to the Delavan house, where she had left her carriage with the doorman.
My invitation is this. I would like to invite you to join the board of the House of Shelter.
She stopped dead. You are the one who funds the House of Shelter?
You see, I can keep secrets. I am already associated with prostitution.
The house is a wonderful service. Several women I've treated have gotten help there. One of them is married, did you know? She lives in Coxsackie now. Another works in the glass factory.
Then you know that I am serious. I would have asked you yesterday at the cemetery, with your husband present, but I felt it would have been an intrusion somehow. I admire you. You seem to be unafraid of anything. My mother was right all those years ago. Do you know what rumors raced around Albany when you left for the war? You were with child, you'd run away to get married, you'd lost your mind. All of us young men were making bets.
How disappointed you must have been when I turned up well-educated and chaste, Mary said.
On the contrary, I won the bet.
Are you really offering me a place on the board?
I am. Though I can assure you that the board is made up of a bunch of sanctimonious priests and pastors who threaten hellfire when our charges don't comply with every rule. And one of those Prine men heads it,
he said, making a face. The Prines were first among the prominent families of Albany, and deeply involved in church affairs. Recently, one of its members had served as a missionary to China. Mary studied the man whose wife thought him obtuse. His top hat did little to shield him from the sunlight, but his eyes, squinting, seemed without guile. He opened one hand in a welcoming gesture, implying he had no motive other than concern and generosity.
All right, then. If you won't answer me now, consider my offer open,
Vanderveer said.
And contemplate this. Should you accept, you would be the first woman in Albany to sit on a board. I have no idea why you haven't been involved with the House of Shelter before, with such an invested interest as this.
He tilted his chin back toward the clinic in approval.
And you must know that Viola was very taken with you yesterday. She loved Mrs. O'Donnell. She's having a tea party this afternoon. One of those obligation teas meant to appease the reigning queens of old Albany.
He made another comic face.
Would you allow me to escort you to our home? Viola would be so pleased to have a moment with you. I realize that it may be too early in your grief for social forays, but you've returned to work, and it would mean a great deal to my wife. Follow me in your carriage?
I enjoyed meeting Viola very much, but I am sorry, I don't have time.
Just a half an hour, that's all.
Another time, perhaps. Do give her my regards, though. Garrett waited while the doorman at the Delavan retrieved Mary's carriage from the hotel's large barns, located several blocks away. He didn't want to leave her unescorted. Mary laughed at his chivalry, for if he knew her at all, he would know she'd traipsed far more dangerous paths than the sidewalks of Albany. Chapter 9 2 years before leaving for Paris, Elizabeth began taking French lessons with Madame Hubbard, who did not give lessons so much as she gave conversation, and not conversation so much as reveries. Madame Hubbard's husband had brought her to Albany from France under protest, and she relived her days there in long, florid descriptions of balls and parties, excursions and entertainments, and divertisements on the general superiority of Paris versus Albany. In these extended musings, Madame Hubbard often talked far beyond Elizabeth's allotted tutorial of 1 hour, and she never assigned declensions, vocabulary lists, or grammar books. What she offered instead was repetitive exposure to the language, and by listening and conversing, Elizabeth had long ago grown facile. Now, upon seeing Elizabeth at her doorstep, Madame Hubbard enveloped her in a perfumed haze of bosom, proclaiming herself overjoyed at once again seeing her darling, darling girl. Unable to express herself precisely in English, she frequently fell back on repeating adjectives to emphasize the depth of her emotions, which were often overwrought, but always welcome to the recipient of her exaggerated Gallic affections. The Frenchwoman was small, plump, and bright-faced, frequently overly powdered, with thinning reddish hair and given to wearing tightly corseted dresses. Elizabeth melted into the shadowy comfort of Madame Hubbard's ample décolletage, feeling as if she'd come home. Home for Madame Hubbard happened to be a large brick mansion situated just west of the Capitol building on Washington Avenue, where from time to time thuds from its ongoing construction penetrated the thick walls of her parlor, which did not now prevent Madame Hubbard from expressing astonishment that Elizabeth had left Paris.
"I left Paris for love, but every day I question whether or not that was reason enough to forsake her, especially for this city. I don't know why a young person like yourself would leave Paris when you had everything before you."
"The O'Donnells..."
"Yes, yes," Madame Hubbard said, leaning forward. "I understand. But, my dear, as sad as it is, you could have grieved there and kept on with your studies."
"I couldn't stay, Madame Hubbard."
Elizabeth had brought with her Victor Hugo's novel Les Misérables. Previously, it had been their practice for Elizabeth to read aloud in French and ask questions about sentence structure and idiom. The French language was the one thing of Paris that Elizabeth missed, the puzzle of the complicated grammar, the challenges of pronouncing the tricky vowels, and most of all, the language's musicality, a lyricism that reminded her of the extended notes of Mozart's most fanciful concertos. She fingered the pages of the book now, hoping to divert Madame Hubbard's attention.
"Tell me the truth, darling mademoiselle," Madame Hubbard continued. "Did they ask you to leave the conservatory? This happens, I am told, especially to foreigners. It is nothing to be ashamed of. You can tell me. I will not think less of you."
Madame Hubbard had come perilously close to the embarrassing truth. But of course Monsieur Gerard had never demanded that Elizabeth leave. Instead, she had taken flight. She had failed in courage. Shame hung around her like a noose. There was so little to tell. So little that she wanted to tell.
"I see," Madame Hubbard said when Elizabeth did not answer. "Perhaps it was love?"
"It was nothing like that."
"You make me guess, mademoiselle, when you do not tell me everything. But anyone can see that you are miserable. You miss playing your violin. I can tell at a moment's glance. This will not do at all."
"But how do you know that I am not playing?"
"Your pain is evident, and it is more than your cherished O'Donnells. You are broken, ma petite. I am so sorry that this happened to you."
Elizabeth stood, her heart pounding in her chest, stammering excuses as she fled the parlor. She had forgotten how perceptive Madame Hubbard could be.
"I'm sorry, but I just remembered that I have another engagement. Will you forgive me?"
The maid held open the front door for her, and dutifully returned to report to Madame Hubbard that Elizabeth had been wiping tears from her eyes. Madame Hubbard brought her teacup to her lips and mused about the complications of youth, worrying for her petite violiniste, who had already borne too much in her young life. Outside, Elizabeth hurried past clusters of men waiting at the omnibus stop. Home was perhaps a mile away, and she walked several long blocks before yielding to her embarrassment. At the corner of Washington Avenue and Lark, a melancholy little corner lacking even a modest dwelling to cheer up the bedraggled empty lot, Elizabeth finally succumbed. Monsieur Gerard's voice replayed itself inside her head.
"You are nothing. You are an embarrassment to the violin. Why did you come all the way from America to shame yourself?"
She pulled a handkerchief from her reticule, turning away so that no passerby could observe her mortification.
"Here now? What's this?"
Elizabeth blinked back her tears, stuffed her handkerchief into her sleeve, and turned to find a young man hovering beside her.
He floated before her, beautifully formed, wide at the shoulders and slim at the hips, possessed of a shock of untamed yellow hair that sprouted from underneath a narrow hat brim. A topcoat covered a fitted jacket, under which a paisley vest glinted in her watery vision. To her blank look, the young man said,
"I am Jacob Vanderveer. We met yesterday at the cemetery.
Might I accompany you? Escort you somewhere? You seem
as if you might appreciate someone to walk with you."
He hesitated, and at length said,
"I beg your pardon. I see that you've forgotten. Of course, you were in a state of grief yesterday and have no memory of meeting me. Please forgive my intrusion."
He lifted his hat and offered an apologetic smile. "I remember you, Mr. Vanderveer."
"Shall we begin again, then? How do you do?" "To spark our conversation, I'll share the details of my day. I was just at the Capitol, attending to some particulars regarding a delivery of lumber. The foreman is unclear how much he needs and when he wants it. The whole thing is a mess, actually, as has been all of the construction there. I was on my way home when I saw you. But if you like, I will wait a few more moments before I proceed, until you make the turn at the park. Would you like that?"
He did not seem to be mocking her. He was striving to make his expression neutral. What was that biblical term, Elizabeth thought? A lack of guile.
"May I offer some perspective?" Jacob said, when she hesitated. "I am aware that accepting the offer of an escort from someone you hardly know, me, poses the uncertainty that I might turn out to be a crashing bore, which I think is your greatest risk. But I promise that I will do everything to entertain you, and thus erase what I believe to be your most likely objection to my presence. I assure you, Miss Fall, that as far as dangers go, the worst offense that I might impose would be a reverential disquisition on the merits of the new ice yacht that my father recently purchased for next week's regatta. On that subject, I may fail in my quest not to bore you, but at your command, I will abandon any subject that you forbid."
Elizabeth stifled a small laugh. She recalled her grandmother's admonition. "But you must try to live, if you can."
"I have an idea," Jacob said, when she still didn't answer. "We'll pretend instead that we don't know one another. We will walk together, but apart, as if we are strangers who have just come upon one another. I will speak indifferently of the weather. You will nod and answer something entirely lifeless. No one will suspect anything. And it might even vanquish the awkwardness. Do I offend you by offering you my company?" Jacob said.
Practice, she thought. Practice being alive. "I am not offended."
"Excellent. However," he said, "I insist upon walking you all the way home. It's only polite. What kind of a protector would I be if I didn't?"
She finally relented, and they fell into wary step beside one another. "Perhaps," Elizabeth said, "I should make clear to you that my unhappiness has nothing to do with you. It is about something else."
"Of course," he said. "I was very fond of Mr. O'Donnell. He was wonderful, hard-working, funny."
"He was," she said.
"And you came back from Paris for them?" Jacob said.
"Yes." Which wasn't a complete lie, but nonetheless it felt dishonest to pretend that all her unhappiness was centered on losing Bonnie and her family. She cast about for something to lead the conversation away from herself. "You are in law?"
"And in lumber. Though lumber doesn't hold the same fascination for me as it does for my father. He breathes lumber. Most nights he comes home smelling of pine sap.
Don't you?
I will always smell of the lumber yard if my father has his way.
And what way is that?
That I take over for him when he dies.
But he will be dead. He will never know whether you do or don't. Her unguarded words slipped out before she had a chance to censor herself. Jacob laughed.
I suppose that's true.
Forgive me, Mr. Vanderveer.
Jacob.
May I say something to you? I suspect you love something else if you are so willing to give up such a lucrative enterprise. Jacob cocked his head, rueful.
My father's sole purpose in having me read law at Harvard was to understand shipping and land rights, learn the acquisition tools for obtaining timberland, and master the art of contract, all of which I find incredibly boring. I love criminal law, though my father will never let me practice.
Why not?
Because I am his son.
They crossed to the other side of Madison to avoid the dust rising from the raising of the row houses. Blows of sledgehammers rang out, like the percussive chops of a bass drum. In New York State, Jacob went on, the tradition was that new lawyers, junior lawyers, were taken on by more practiced attorneys and apprenticed. But it was only a tradition, not a law. Jacob, if he wanted, could set out his shingle today and work without the advisement of a more senior attorney. But that would mean abandoning his father. His father claimed he needed him, and Jacob liked to think of himself as a dutiful son.
You must have other interests, Elizabeth said, besides law.
Travel. I have always wanted to go to Paris.
I wouldn't set my sights on Paris. It is a great disappointment. Not what one dreams it will be.
Such weary knowingness, he said, eyeing her.
I am sorry. You should go, she said, to see for yourself whether or not it is what people say.
Perhaps I will, he said.
They strolled up the avenue, easier in their silence now. On the southern edge of the park, only a few houses besides the Stips had been built. In the distance, the dirty bricks of the almshouse hulked, and boys playing stickball kicked up shimmering wakes of dust.
"Will I see you there when I go?" Jacob said.
"No," Elizabeth said. "I won't be returning."
"So you are finished with your studies?"
"I have given up playing," she said.
"What a shame."
They'd reached home. She could feel the weight of his gaze.
"So it was you who loved something once, and now you no longer do?" he said.
A sparrow flitted in the branches of a red maple above her head. She tucked her book to her chest. He had turned her question back on her. The problem with trying to live, she thought, was that it was impossible to hide. He smiled at her.
"I see. You may ask probing spiritual questions of me, but not I of you. I understand the rules. If I agree to ask you nothing personal, ever, may I come another day to call on you? Or perhaps instead you would like to go to the ice regatta with me next week, if the ice holds? We would be lost in the crowd. You could pretend you don't know me."
Elizabeth ducked her head and smiled. She couldn't ever recall meeting anyone this charming. "Thank you for the flowers yesterday." He grinned.
"Wear a warm coat. It gets cold on the ice."
Chapter 10.
"No," Amelia said, a look of intense pain clouding her features. "No."
She'd been saying no ever since Mary had started talking. Though Mary had had some time to accustom herself to the idea, she still was not able to keep the fear from her voice. In the past few minutes, she had recounted Darlene's suspicions to her mother, along with Mantell's visit, whispering to keep her voice from carrying.
Beyond the closed pocket doors of the dining room, the last of William's patients colonized the parlor, waiting his turn to be seen in William's clinic on the other side of the stairwell. Amelia was pacing, following the pattern of inlaid mahogany in the dining room floor, tracing a path from the glassed-in medicine and instrument cabinets to the exam table, strands of hair working loose from the lilac ribbon holding her silver strands in place. Her dress was muted lavender silk, with a line of simple buttons decorating the neck and wrists.
"No," Amelia said again. "It can't be. We buried Emma and Claire yesterday."
"But we didn't, did we?" Amelia turned away, looking out the back window into the garden, where a wash of late afternoon light was filtering through a western bank of low clouds.
"No."
All those weeks she and William had wasted, going from orphanage to orphanage, Mary thought. And now every second, every minute seemed wasted. She ought to be down on the waterfront right now, going from brothel to brothel, at least the ones she knew. The women would admit her, happily. All that goodwill from her medical care would stand her in good stead. They all knew her, or at least of her. She could count on that.
"But think, Mary," Amelia said, gripping Mary's wrist. "Do you think it's possible that you are merely reaching out of hope?"
"Maybe. Perhaps."
"I don't know," Mary said,
giving in to doubt again. One minute Darlene's theory seemed brilliant, and the next completely implausible.
"And," Amelia said, "do you think it's possible that the captain could be right about Darlene? That she might be planning to extort money from you in exchange for information? Information that might turn out not to be true?"
"I trust her, Mother. She's no opportunist. If she'd wanted money, she would have asked me for it then, wouldn't she have? If she intended to lie? And besides, none of that matters, does it, if we go looking ourselves? The brothels are the single place we haven't looked. What harm can come from looking? I can't understand why Captain Mantell refused. Oh, damn him! The police know exactly where the brothels are. It would be so easy for them."
"But the captain doesn't believe that they're alive."
"But what does that matter?" Mary broke off at the sound of footsteps and the rustle of skirts coming down the back stairs. Elizabeth emerged from the butler's pantry, her hair tied back with a thick band of striped ribbon. The narrow worry line that had cropped up between her eyes had deepened. Mary pasted a smile on her face.
"Did you enjoy Madame Hubbard's?"
She was aware that her voice was far too bright, but Elizabeth flared so easily these days, like tinder, that it was impossible to strike the right tone.
"Not especially. Should I help Uncle William with his patients?"
"Are you well, Lizzie?" her grandmother asked.
"You seem..." "I'm fine."
Not even Amelia could loosen Elizabeth's tongue. Amelia, who could pry anything from anyone.
"Well then, I'm certain that your uncle would appreciate your help," Amelia said. "He'll be happy that you want to."
Elizabeth padded through the room, opening the pocket doors wide to the now empty parlor, as a sudden, brief cry from William's clinic resounded throughout the house. They watched Elizabeth quicken her pace, round the staircase, and disappear down the hall.
"Was that enthusiasm?" Mary said.
"I hope so," Amelia said.
"It would be good if she could find something to do. If Bonnie were here, she might be able to..."
"Mother..."
"I'm sorry,"
Amelia said.
"Sometimes, I know," Mary said.
But Elizabeth wasn't needed. William was following his patient to the front door, calling after him as he stumbled onto the veranda, a sling supporting his right arm. Soon he was lurching down Madison Avenue in the opposite direction of downtown.
"The other way, Mr. Matthews. The other way," William yelled,
waving him in the other direction. The man swung around, nodded, and trotted back down the street. Just then, an omnibus lurched by and stopped for him, and he clambered aboard and scrambled onto a seat, dazedly staring out the window. William shook his head as he came into Mary's clinic.
He insisted on going right away, but I don't think he was altogether right when he got here. I've set more than 1,000 bones, and he's the only one who's bellowed like a cow in heat. And for a tiny fracture, too. He'd never have made it during the war,
William said, shaking his head. He turned and looked at Mary.
Good God. What's the matter?
William was seated, holding his head in his hands.
I'll go tonight. I'll go now.
Mary and Amelia threw one another a furtive look. We're going with you. William looked from his wife to his mother-in-law, both of them equally insistent, both of them more than capable of prolonging the conversation beyond his level of tolerance. Though he frequently accused them of being in the habit of deciding what to do, and only then informing him of their plans, he rarely disagreed with them. But he did now.
Neither of you is going.
We know where the brothels are better than you do, William. At least I hope that's the case,
Amelia said, shooting a grimly amused glance at Mary.
And they know us. We've helped them. Mary certainly has, in ways that no one else...
I shall point out the obvious,
William said.
At night, if a man and a woman enter that particular type of enterprise together, it will look suspicious. It will be easier for a man alone to make inquiries.
I'm going, Mary said. We don't have to go at night, Amelia said. Tomorrow morning, instead, then.
No, tomorrow is too late, Mary said. So much wasted time already.
Mary,
William said.
Your going would be broadcast within seconds between the houses. I will draw no special notice. And the chances that they are alive...
I know. I know. But what if they are? We have to look again. We have to...
Hush, Amelia said, laying a hand on Mary's shoulder. Where is Elizabeth? They could hear the sound of rushing water in the bathroom and resumed talking in a whisper.
You cannot go alone, Amelia said. What if something happens?
William cocked his head.
And just what would you do, Amelia Sutter, if something happened?
Alert the police,
because they've been so helpful.
It was, William stated again, idiotic for either of them to accompany him. But when darkness fell, Mary climbed into the carriage with him. She and Amelia had scribbled out a long list of the addresses of all the brothels where they had delivered babies. William did not tell them that they needn't have bothered, for a brothel was as obvious a structure as the nose on a man's face. One only had to follow the trail. Later that night, a full hour after the lamplighters had made their midnight rounds to snuff the gaslights lining Broadway, the thoroughfare began to empty of revelers, whose dissipation belied an uncanny ability to navigate their way home in the early morning blackness. They crept up the slope of Arbor Hill to the west, with its quiet hum of tenements and feral hogs rooting among the blackberry vines, or tripped up Broadway into North Albany, where lumber handlers and their families populated wooden row houses by the hundreds, and sour wives awaited their drunken husbands. Some, too inebriated to make it home, bedded down next to the Erie Canal's towpath. William and Mary leaned against the ridged siding of a stationer's store, watching the nocturnal evacuation. All night, William had followed fidgety, purposeful men from one bawdy house to another, where girls far too young to be in the prostitution business were secreted in back rooms. He'd scanned small face after small face for Emma and Claire, trying to see through face paint and bruises, and too much of the wrong kind of experience. At the last house, the madam had traded in blackmail, You asked for young, she trilled, her hand outstretched for coins. A dozen houses tonight. How many more were there? Mary had slipped into the alleyways behind the houses, just in